The centenary of the birth of Arnold Schoenberg, the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation presents a documentary fantasy by Glenn Gould. The participants, in addition to Mr. Schoenberg, who is heard on a tape made available to us courtesy of the Schoenberg estate, include, in order of appearance, conductor and musicologist Dennis Stevens, composers Ernst Krennick and John Cage, conductor Eric Leinsdorf, and author Henri-Louis de Lagrange. Schoenberg, the first 100 years.
This reminds me of an event which occurred about 50 years ago in Vienna. Our Emperor Francis Joseph I usually honored openings of important industrial or artistic expositions by his presence. On such occasions, the chairman of the committees were allowed to present prominent industrialists and artists to the Emperor. In this special case, the chairman did it as it was customary with ordinary citizens. Your Majesty, may I present Mr. So-and-so, a great industrialist. Thereafter, turning to the gentleman, he asked, His Majesty, the Emperor. After he had done that several times, the Emperor said softly, By now, I hope the gentleman will know who I am.
I think the point about Schoenberg's view of history is the fact that he grew up in a city, in Vienna, that was tremendously conscious of its past. Until very recent years, you could hardly hear any music in Vienna apart from the music of their own composers. I recall at one time giving a concert of Baroque Italian music there, and it seemed a very normal repertory as far as we were concerned, but for the Viennese it was totally new. They were used to their diet of Schubert and Bruckner and Brahms and so on, and I think that even in Schoenberg's time, perhaps more so, there was this element of the traditional that was enormously ingrown. And I suppose partly due to that, he became the composer that he was, forward-looking, independent, and absolutely original.
Yes, well, I think that's true, certainly. But in his personality, there was certainly a conservative or disciplinarian trend. He was a man of law and order, to be sure. He never referred to himself as a revolutionary. He always said, I came to fulfill the law, not to break it.
Well, he used frequently to say, referring to a particular group of notes, Bach did so and so with these, Beethoven did so and so, Brahms did so and so, and then speaking of himself in the third person, he would say, and Schoenberg did this. And without any embarrassment and giving no feeling that he was being pretentious.
If I may put it in these terms, that we all carry our fate with us, that our own fate is subject to our direction. Now, Schoenberg's mind was a complex mind. And I do not wish for one moment to make synonymous complex and great. There are the most simple pieces by Mozart, which are also some of the greatest. So simple does not mean simpleton. It means just what it says, and I think he had a complex mind from birth. And in this respect, he was very close to a composer whom he quite consciously admired hugely, and that was Brahms. Now, Brahms, when you go into his larger works, never does less than two themes at the same time. Certainly in the symphonies, you have always two things going at the same time. Well, I think that Schoenberg already in Gurrelieder has always more than one thing going at a time. It is always the complex musical mind. It is never the simple musical mind.
I know that he saw himself more as a descendant of Brahms than of Wagner. He saw the line coming down from Beethoven, Brahms, and then to his own constructive tendencies. Although in his early works, a Gurrelieder and such things, one always feels the vicinity of Wagner. But he didn't see that. He felt he was much more a pupil of Brahms.
Well, that's one view of his backward-looking idea of history. There again, Vienna was to the fore, and I think that all the Viennese feel this, don't you? I believe Calvo Caressi, in a study called The Classicism of Arnold Schoenberg, quotes the composer as saying, "What I know, I have learned from thorough study of the music of Bach, Mozart, Beethoven, Wagner, and Brahms." And incidentally, they're the ones you just named, so there must be something in this linking of the man with those Germanic predecessors.
It's been said by many people, although I've never found concrete evidence of this, that Mahler attended some of the first rehearsals of Verklärte Nacht when the Rosé Quartet was performing it in 1902. As you know, Rosé was Mahler's brother-in-law. And unfortunately, Mahler was in Russia at the time of the first performance, but some of the rehearsals are supposed to have taken place in some of the rehearsal rooms at the opera, and Mahler apparently heard some of these. However, later, there was a very close connection, because Guido Adler, who was a great friend of Mahler, brought Schoenberg to Mahler's house, and therefore the scenes that Alma Mahler has described of these very stormy meetings in which Schoenberg went into what Alma calls his usual paradoxes, which made Mahler extremely mad, these must have happened during their first meetings, I suppose, in March or April 1904. But to go back to counterpoint, which I think is a very interesting point that you made about Schoenberg, what's so interesting, I think, about Schoenberg is that he was self-taught.
I think he was very, very conscious of this, I don't know, it wasn't a feeling of inadequacy, because an autodidact can often turn out to be a remarkable character of an extreme originality and utter independence. He hasn't been spoiled by book learning, and he hasn't been interfered with by pedants, and I think this is admirable. And I think that this was Schoenberg's attitude, that although he was part of this tradition, he was going to strike out on a limb and do something totally different. Isn't that really what happens?
Invention, I don't think, has one way or the other anything to do with learning. The inventiveness of a man, I think, is the grace that is bestowed upon him. I find, for instance, that Bruckner is a genius, but not a good composer. I find that Mahler is a much better composer than Bruckner, and on occasion, no genius at all. But may I go back to something earlier? The counterpoint that you mentioned is very closely connected with what kind of thematic material you use. And the story I like best is the one, be it apocryphal or not, makes no difference. When Bach was asked, I don't know if it was the King of Prussia or who, if he could improvise a six-part fugue. After he had been given themes to improvise on, he said, yes, indeed, but for this I have to invent my own subject, that I cannot do on a given subject because it may not lend itself to six-part treatment. Now, I think there is an essence how Bach invents his themes for three-part fugues, for four-part fugues, and for five-part fugues, how different the structure of the thematic material is. And I believe that Mahler, essentially, in his inventiveness, with the text and the song in mind, could not bend the invention enough to suit the contrapuntal treatment.
But the trouble with Mahler was that he was always so busy at the opera that he really, I'm sure, never had time to sit down and write. So I'm sure he had an inferiority complex, for the simple reason that he had failed at the conservatory and towards the end of his life complained of not having enough contrapuntal ability. And I think this whole explosion of the Eighth Symphony, which I think Adorno so cleverly calls creating a masterpiece out of the very inability of the period to create a masterpiece, which I think is a very clever idea, although it sounds so paradoxical. I think the explosion of the Eighth Symphony was proving to himself and to the world that he could be a great contrapuntalist. I think for him, the lead had to be based on a musical idea. I think one of the interesting facts about his career is that in quite a few cases, he found a theme, thought this was going to go into a symphony, and discovered after that that this was the ideal music for a text that he had thought of setting before. He always insisted on form in the lead, and for him, form, clarity, which was his ideal throughout his life and all his composing, remained terribly important. And the words were slightly secondary. And this is why often he repeats verses, repeats words, and so on. This, of course, shocked many contemporaries. And I suppose this is not true of Schoenberg.
So probably Mahler was reluctant, and Schoenberg was not, to bend the invention toward the possibility, because contrapuntal treatment cannot be done to every single, for instance, the opening statement of the Eroica does not give you the possibility for much contrapuntal treatment, because in repeating a triad on various inversions, that is no contrapuntal treatment. It makes for a fantastic fabric, but it is not counterpoint in the sense in which we are discussing.
I agree with absolutely everything you say. I think basically Schoenberg was far more romantic than Mahler. I think that the enormous admiration that Schoenberg had for Mahler really was conceived rather late. Originally, Schoenberg was completely negative. Then, in December 1904, when Mahler conducted the third in Vienna, then suddenly Schoenberg had a revelation, and he discovered that Mahler was a very great composer. Now, I wonder if he wasn't putting the man and the music together. I think the man had had such an enormous impact in his own life in the past 6 months only, but such a strong impact, that he immediately thought of Mahler as a saint. But I think also he must have realized that there was a world of difference between Mahler himself. And he considered, I think, Mahler as a predecessor much more as a man than as a composer. But I really think that Verklärte Nacht had impressed Mahler very, very much. And he had decided immediately that Schoenberg was a genius.
Genius, let me tell you a funny story about genius. In 1956, was the centenary of Sigmund Freud, and for the centennial lecture in New York's town hall, the New York Psychoanalytic Society had invited Dr. Ernest Jones to come over from London. And I was interested to hear the lecture, and I called one of my very good friends, the late Dr. Heinz Hartmann, an eminent disciple of Freud and psychoanalyst in his own right. And we were standing in town hall, in front of our seats, waiting for the beginning of the lecture, and of course, everybody knew everybody else. It was like a large family party. And Heinz Hartmann had the program in his hand and the title of the lecture. He read out The Nature of Genius. But he said, I don't think we'll find out tonight either. Has it ever been discussed in your presence that perhaps the First World War was such a complete watershed, not only for Schoenberg, it was for Stravinsky and even for Strauss, that afterwards they were not the same? Schoenberg certainly was not the same. Schoenberg found himself, because he was the 20th century, not the 19th century, essentially, and Strauss lost himself because he was the outgoing Wilhelmian Empire. So the First World War is really the end of a civilization in more senses than one.
I've really eluded Strauss a little bit. Well, for one thing, I don't admire Strauss nearly as much as Mahler, although I know he's a very great composer. I think the reason why I don't is that I find his personality so thoroughly antipathique, as we say in French. But however, that's not saying that I don't think Strauss is a great composer. I don't know if you agree about that.
You're perfectly right there. I would agree with you insofar that both came from Wagner. I mean, Strauss and Schoenberg. It is like a crossroads. At the beginning of the crossroads stands Wagner, and he sends these two boys out. For a while they go fairly parallel. Eventually they went in different directions.
No, I'm quite certain that you're right, and I think that Strauss was very much more a progressive composer, taking up where Wagner had stopped and going towards Schoenberg. Strauss discovered Schoenberg and I think worked very hard to try and give him a position in Berlin. I know that the harmony in Strauss is more progressive. I know that if you hear Verklärte Nacht, the shadow of Strauss is just as important as that of Wagner or that of Brahms in many ways.
We cannot deny it, and I don't want to become in any way involved either in Zeitgeist per se, because one can carry this much too far. But there is obviously an end to the 19th century in those August days of 1914. The world was destroyed in more senses than one, was never the same again. Now Strauss lost his bearings. Of course, these men were all exceedingly sensitive, and certainly the only period in Schoenberg's time when he didn't produce anything followed 1912. Because obviously there was a crisis which he didn't know how to cope with.
I don't really believe that Mahler would have become much more advanced, certainly not in the way of harmony, because after all, Mahler's basic conception in music, he expressed, I think, to Sibelius, if I remember, when he said that writing a symphony was building a universe with all the means at his disposal. I think that
in any case, for quite a few years to come, he would very definitely have gone on writing very big, very long works, because this is the way he felt that he was expressing himself. I think that he did feel himself that he belonged to a dying world, and this dying world we discover nowadays was a very prophetic one. I don't think Mahler would have ever accepted himself to write miniatures. I don't think he could possibly have accepted serial techniques, but these were, of course, born only in the 1920s. Alma states that Schoenberg one day explained the whole idea of Klangfarbe Melodie to Mahler, and that he was quite horrified by this, that he thought this couldn't possibly work. But anyway, the other thing that Alma says, which is very important about Mahler towards Schoenberg, she says that after these discussions, when Mahler felt that Schoenberg was being too modern and too advanced and he didn't understand what he said, Mahler would say, "Of course, I don't follow him and I don't understand all his music. However, I am the past and he is the future. Therefore, he must be right."
Well, I think Adorno made some statements to that effect, that this music foreshadowed the destruction of the empire and the whole crisis of the civilization which started the First World War, that there's this feeling of catastrophe in this music. And this was the last contribution to the continuity of musical thought on the part of Austria.
Have you ever read the Berg introduction to his Wozzeck, his lecture? Well, this is a fantastic thing, and I can only speculate if it was in Schoenberg's mind, that idea expressed by Berg. To give briefly the background, in the late 20s, when Wozzeck, after the initial enormous success in Berlin, was immediately accepted, I don't know, by 20, 30 of the provincial opera houses of Germany, Alban Berg went, and a few days before the local premieres, gave a lecture. And this lecture starts with a statement that in 1914, at the time when he was beginning to think of Wozzeck and made his plans, when he started to sketch it, the atonal composers of the Viennese school were only composing small pieces. And that he found, when he studied the whole question, that in order to compose larger forms, symphonies, operas, large choral works, works of large dimension, that there had to be something which replaced the tonal cadence.
Well, that would be the period of the so-called free atonality, if I understand this correctly. The period between 1910 and 1920, approximately, before the 12-tone technique, what we call loosely the expressionistic period, where there is not so much constructive tendency in music, but rather intense expression of sentiment and big skips in the melodies and the harsh dissonances, the violent contrasts and all of that. Frequently, it was very crowded and very busy, very, very dense. That must have been a propensity of his, because I noticed that even in the thing like, I think it's called Models for Beginners. That's a kind of manual for composition students. Even there, in these examples, which are very simple pieces, already in the third bar, everything is full of 16 notes. It's something he was driven to. I don't know what it was. And I feel this very frequently in his larger and substantial pieces too. And that simply doesn't appeal to me personally, I mean.
Well, this is of course reflected in the writings of Adorno, and I say often, without wanting to be funny, I wish that somebody would translate Adorno. I don't mean into English, I mean first into German, the language in which he wrote, allegedly, but it is a German which I find gets so dense after two pages that I have to pause. I cannot read more than very short time Adorno at any one sitting. Now, you are actually saying more or less the same about this very densely packed music. It would be as if one gives a lecture and every sentence is so overly filled with information that people say, now, wait a moment, Mr. Lecturer, give us a few seconds or a few minutes to rest our mind. And I think there has been in the whole school, the whole Second Viennese school, that urge of proving all the time that you are on solid ground. And this is very Germanic. I'm not a mass psychologist in that I venture to comment on what the Germanic hang-up is, but it goes through all art and through all art appreciation in German-speaking lands that things, in order to be important, have to be. And now comes the equation. Probably in theater it has to be in verse, or in music it has to be counterpoint, in order to be important. So there is some kind of belief that things have to be right, numerologically, if you please, because that, of course, makes always for the most easily discernible perfection.
Naturally, there are regressive elements. There's no doubt about that. It is a kind of discipline which one could interpret as a reactionary element. And perhaps this is actually parallel to the ideas of neoclassicism, only in a completely different medium, in the sense that it represents a restriction of freedom, there's no doubt. And it's the curious fact that Schoenberg, after he started working in the 12-tone technique, in so many pieces returned to the classical forms, the sonata and rondo and variations and suite and that sort of thing, which, in a sense, is a restrictive tendency.
But what one wonders is why he didn't break completely with the past. Why did he go back to the 18th century? I think he might have referred to 18th century forms in order to compensate for the, at that time, incomprehensibility of 12-tone music.
He was very emphatic about music being a question of repetition and variation. And he defined variation, perhaps this is well known, I don't know, but he defined variation as repetition, in which some things remained of what was being varied and some things were changed. So the variation itself was repetition. And he liked variation to become more and more complex and far removed from the subject being varied.
I would think that for Schoenberg, the system was never a purpose. At least he was very outspoken on the subject.
There are all these elements which actually break the stylistic unity of the atonal style. Well, you know what I'm referring to. It's the monologue of Marie and the military music and all these things which really don't belong to this kind of style. Schoenberg would never have done that, and not Webern either. I think they were more purist. Now, I must say that as a person, I'm much more attached to the music of Webern. I noticed that already in the 1930s when I started working in the traditional technique myself. That was really what I was trying to accomplish, this very pure, crystal clear style, no unnecessary details and everything reduced to the absolutely necessary.
When I heard those very sharp pieces, the string quartet, I recall being absolutely electrified by that music. I was sitting, practically not sitting, on the chair in the hall, and every sound was so important. The same was true when Metropolis conducted the Opus 21. What was so astonishing in the Opus 21, to me, analyzing it, was that in a canonic situation, a horn was not imitated by a violin, but by a horn. So that he had a sense of sound, well, that was close to my feeling for noises.
In the 1930s, I felt that outside of this province of atonality and traditional technique, there was a great wasteland, musical wasteland, inhabited by the neoclassicists. They seemed to dominate everything until 1945, when things changed radically and suddenly.
I had naturally found neoclassicism very seductive, but it was exactly that seductiveness and its relative absence in Schoenberg's music that made me think, perhaps in a puritanical way, that Schoenberg's music was more important. Neoclassicism struck me as it did Varèse. Varèse, you know, described neoclassicism as, what was it? He had some awful thing to say about it. It was a complete loss of intelligence, I believe. At any rate, I found the idea of the 12 tones something that one could think about and imagine things happening that had not yet happened.
Well, Schoenberg objected to the kind of neoclassicism that possessed very few really new elements. For example, he disliked the use of pedal points, preferring elaborate bass parts, moving harmony. He disliked ostinatos and sequences. Instead, he preferred developing variation. He also didn't like fugatos or dissonances of the kind that merely disguised the vulgarity of the thematic material. And he also hated the kind of polyphony that he called not true counterpoint. If you remember that cantata of his, was it 1925, De Neoclassicismus? He wrote his own libretto to that, I think. And at one point, I remember the bass sings, "The components of art operate according to the letters of the alphabet," to which the soprano and alto reply, "If one knows his alphabet," which gets us a little down to detail.
Well, what we thought about Stravinsky, one can see in the preface to his three satires, you know, these choruses for men's voices, which he wrote in the 20s. And there are some very nasty digs against Stravinsky in this preface. And if I may say so, also one against me, because at that time I was rather immature, naturally, in these years. I was just 23 or so. And I had attacked Schoenberg's 12-tone technique in a lecture. And he must have heard about that and was naturally furious. I was told afterwards that in the papers which he left, there were several pages of writing where he discussed me and this incident in very derogatory terms, naturally. And so in his preface to the three satires, he also made a little remark on my name, a rather poor pun. But we made up afterwards.
By this time, Schoenberg had gone to Los Angeles, and so I drove west and presented myself to Schoenberg. And he said, "You probably can't pay my price." And I said, "You don't need to mention it because I have no money." And he said, "Will you devote your life to music?" And I said, "Certainly." And it was the second time I'd been asked such a question, not about music, but about the devotion of my life. I'd been asked that by an architect with whom I was studying architecture in Paris. And then I had said, "No, I won't devote my life to architecture." But when Schoenberg asked me if I would devote my life to music, I said, "Certainly." So he said, well, he would teach me free of charge. And somehow I think I haven't been unfaithful. Once I showed him one of my compositions, and he refused to look at it. It was a piece for a clarinet solo, and I think that the idea of a single line was repugnant to him. He was very involved, as you know, in harmony. And it was my realization that I had no feeling for harmony that led to my stopping working with him.
Well, I would say he was rather difficult. In conversation, one had always to watch what one said, to be sure not to use any wrong terms or to express opinions which he would not approve of or which he would reject. One was always a little bit on one's guard. It was quite different from a conversation with Stravinsky, for instance, which was always very relaxed and informal. But with Schoenberg, it was touching.
Get out! The sergeant will be furious!
And I frequently used to chauffeur Schoenberg around Los Angeles. And in the course of one of those drives, I explained to him that I had no feeling for harmony, and I think he already understood this from the way I did the work. I could do it correctly, but I couldn't do it with any feeling.
And not fast enough.
And he said, well, without a feeling for harmony, you'll never be able to write music. And I said, why not? And he said, you'll come to a wall and you won't be able to get through it. And I said, well, I'll simply bang my head against that wall.
Young or old, strong or sick, guilty or innocent, it was painful to hear the groaning, moaning I heard it, though I had been hit very hard. All
power. Certainly it was easier in his late years in Los Angeles. He was mellowed by age, although he was still looking for enemies. There were no enemies around, but he had still this fighting spirit, was writing letters constantly to attack, abuse his right and left. And his wife told me then that many of the letters were not actually sent, but he was still in a fighting mood. And it was sometimes difficult because he would make challenging statements as if testing you. How you would react, whether you would feel this was so outrageous that you had to protest, and then he would start a fight.
I absolutely worshipped him. I believed everything he said, so that when I said that I would bang my head against this wall, I realized the truth of what he was saying, but I also realized the truth of my own predicament.
We shall strive from this day of atonement till the next to avoid.
But the question is whether the change of milieu caused certain changes in the musical output, because we are unable to tell what Schoenberg would have written without being forced into this change of milieu. So if we find in Schoenberg's late period a suite for strings or things like that, the organ variations, or eventually even in the 12 tone works like the Ode to Napoleon, some tonal elements, it's hard to tell whether this is due to being influenced by the American atmosphere, trying to conform to certain ideas, or whether he might have done that anyway, even if he had stayed in Europe.
I think if the question is one of a change of style when Schoenberg came to live in America, one can say with some qualification, yes, there was, and it's possible now, through hindsight, to regard it as a parallel of Stravinsky's change of style, whereas the one moved away from 12-tone music, the other moved towards it. And I think to some extent there's a complementary feeling there.
It's inconceivable that Schoenberg would have done anything but spite the Hollywood community. The whole life of this man has been marked by a battle to avoid compromise in any form. It was the sternest and most unbending honesty. And one can say many things, but this is an opinion which is totally unfounded. I don't think that there's any concession. I think in the works you mention, Schoenberg is trying to come on the highest level of artistry to terms with the ghastliness of the time.
When I left Schoenberg, I began literally not banging my head, but banging and exploring things that could be rubbed or struck. I was extremely interested in noise, and when I decided to devote myself to noises and to percussion, I was impressed by Schoenberg's insistence upon structure and tonality, and seeing that with the noises I would not have harmony or tonality, but that I ought to have a structure, I examined the physical aspects of sound, the pitch, the duration, the timbre, and I saw that the only aspect of sound that existed when there was no sound was duration.
Yes, because Schoenberg himself didn't touch surrealism at all. He only organized the sequence of pictures, but otherwise it just didn't occur to him. But if you organize more and more, then it gets more and more chaotic. In my opinion, it's the inherent dialectics of the serial principle that the more parameters you reorganize, the less predictable the overall result will be. And in that sense, I open a door to chance.
And so I thought that the structure of music should be not, as Schoenberg had thought, based on the frequency aspect of sound, but it should be based on the duration aspect of sound. And by doing that, I could have come in contact with music of the Middle Ages.
Yes,
but instead, my mind ran to Indian music. And I made not an imitation of Indian music, but what I called a micro-macrocosmic rhythmic structure, so that if I had a whole, I would divide it into a number of measures that was capable of having a square root. So that, say, a sharp piece would have 100 measures, then it would be divided into 10 tens. That would enable me to divide each 10 measures into phrases that would reflect the division of the 10 tens into parts, so that the large parts of the composition would have the same proportion as the small parts would.
But I think that's, of course, a dangerous business, since the avant-garde of today could raise the same objection against Boulez, that he got stuck with serialism instead of proceeding immediately into this new world of freedom which we are enjoying now.
This whole question of tradition in music, which we're concerned about so much with Schoenberg, keeps recurring because composers have come to me and said, look, what do we do nowadays if we want to organize our works? How can we possibly reproduce something like medieval isorhythm? So I said, well, why not just use it? So one finds from time to time this willingness on the part of contemporary composers to subject themselves to a kind of discipline that was perhaps unknown since 1600 or even 1500. Schoenberg wrote to Webern at some time and said, apropos of some lectures on 12-tone music, he said, I would recommend your possibly arranging the analyses in such a way, by choice of works, as to show the logical development towards 12-tone composition. Thus, the Netherlands school and Bach for counterpoint, Mozart for phrasing, but also for handling of motives, then Beethoven, but also Bach for development, Brahms and possibly Mahler for varied and complex treatment. He was very much concerned with analyzing the works of those composers, showing how things ticked. And yet, although he didn't withhold information deliberately, he must, especially in recent years in L.A., have seemed rather like some kind of very senior musicologist who was also a composer and was perhaps more concerned with analyzing than with actually teaching composition.
Well, that's certainly difficult to interpret. I had some talks with him about the history. Because when I was teaching in America in St. Paul, I became very much interested in the ideas of the old music. I was particularly interested in isorhythmic motets of the 14th century, because I saw in many of these early manifestations of composition four tokens of what we were doing. Now, it occurred to me that Schoenberg had very little sense for that. He was not interested at all. He said, I don't care, how should people write like Palestrina? And it was difficult to make him understand that I didn't want him to write like Palestrina at all. And he said, I just select from these old styles whatever seems to me still alive, like inverted cambiata or something like that. So he just saw in that, let's say, a repository of devices.
Well, if the question is, if one looks at Schoenberg's theories from a very, very long distance in the future, whether we would find they are simply leading away into nowhere or whether they make some really lasting impression. And I could say this is certainly a very, very valid a succession of events in the historical continuum.
Well, that is
one
really
finds it
very
first of all, I think,
question.
In the 14th century, late 14th
like
century
asking
French composers,
what Napoleon had said to Hitler,
experimented
but
with notation.
I would imagine that he
in
would
such
have
a complex
had
way
understood
that
the
works are very, very difficult to perform even now.
Transform technique into theories,
rather tackle.
But
some
I don't think
in the early school, as far as late 14th century French composers, the notation is so fantastic, and even if you can transcribe it, you still don't get the feeling, the rhythmic feeling of the original notation, which is often red and blue and black and so on, or black void or red void. It carries with it rhythmic undercurrents that are extremely difficult to grasp. And this was obviously a kind of private group, a cena, and they just performed each other's compositions, and they were as
well,
astute and
exactly
complicated as they wanted to be. No one interfered with them. But what it did lead to was
the
clarity
of
those in Dunstable.
Visiting.
So I think that there again, the practical
much about
outlook
anything.
Of the composer ties in with his theoretical ideas.
They tried to write
and moving on to the
designs
next
on
example
paper
to Schoenberg,
or
one finds the
improvised
kind of
things
he was
on
a
tapes
man,
or invent games.
In many ways, a practical musician.
Tried at least.
He knew
one
what
the students
expected of him as a
3 or 4 weeks.
And he never wrote
a
things
single
utterly
note.
Impossible.
What are you
I remember
doing?
One time it was said that the violin concerto had played
a
game. Someone had said that before you showed how. And I think this is generally true.
The playing
techniques have been developed to cope with this world.
And
one can say that Schoenberg certainly made an impact on his world in the same way that the mannerists, as they're called, in the 14th century, made an impact on theirs.
And so, well, there were several such such characters there. And naturally, I don't think they had much esteem for Schoenberg or anything else.
I'm afraid that he stayed away too long to come back now.
Now, I don't know whether this is typical, but I have heard lots of musical essays in Europe and here, which
I think
seem
he'd
to be
absolutely shocked.
I don't know what answer I would get if I would ask such people what they think about Schoenberg.
Had he come back a little sooner, he might have corrected our evil ways.
Never referred to himself as a revolutionary. He always said, I came to fulfill the law, not to break it.
I think Mahler did feel himself that he belonged to a dying world. But Mahler would say, I am the past and Schoenberg is the future, therefore he must be right.
I think Schoenberg grew up in a city that was tremendously conscious of its past. And I suppose partly due to that, he became the composer that he was, forward-looking, independent, and absolutely original.
May I say what comes immediately to mind? There was a little doggerel which we heard in our school years about a German poet, Klopstock. Wer wird nicht einen Klopstock loben, doch wird ihn jeder lesen, nein. Wir wollen wenige gelobt, dafür aber mehr gelesen sein. Which means in this little doggerel form, who won't be found praising Klopstock to the sky, but will everyone read him? Well, we might prefer to be read more and lauded a little less.
This reminds me of an event which occurred about 50 years ago in Vienna. In this special case, chairmen of the committees were allowed to present prominent industrialists and artists to the emperor. After he had done that several times, the emperor said softly, by now I hope the gentlemen will know who I am. May I hope in another 50 years they will also know who I am.
Schoenberg, The First 100 Years, a documentary fantasy for radio. The participants, in order of appearance, Arnold Schoenberg, Dennis Stevens, Ernst Krennick, John Cage, Eric Leinsdorf, and Henri-Louis de Lagrange. In addition to excerpts from 11 original works by Schoenberg and from the composer's transcriptions of music by Johannes Brahms and Johann Strauss, the program also included works by Gustav Mahler, Richard Strauss, Alban Berg, Anton Webern, Aaron Copland, Sergei Prokofiev, Francis Poulenc, Igor Stravinsky, John Cage, Guillaume Damachaux, Guillaume Dufay, and Karlheinz Stockhausen. The program was produced by Glenn Gould in association with the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation. Technical supervision, Donald Logan. This is George McLean speaking.
The preceding show was recorded at Wave Farms WGXC in the Hudson Valley in New York State.